this is an interview with John Gildard for the Youngstown State University Veterans Project and the Oral History Program. Being interviewed by David Costello at 449 Crandall at approximately 3 o'clock on November 22nd, 1974. Good afternoon, John. First, I'd like to ask you just some introductory questions about your experience in the service. Why did you go into the service?
I had one or two choices. Is that loud enough for you? Okay. Either get drafted in the Army or enlist in the Navy. So I took the latter one and enlisted in the Navy.
I see. And so how long were you in the service?
Active duty, 4 years.
4 years. And when did you go into the service?
I was sworn in on the 14th of July and then I left for active duty on the 28th of September,
1965.
And I was released from active duty the 22nd of September, 69.
I see. And where did you go to your basic training?
San Diego, California.
San Diego. How long were you there?
28th of September till the 7th of December.
And after you finished your basic training, did you go to any schools or have any?
I was assigned to Phase 1 of Gunner's Mate Technician A School, Great Lakes, Illinois.
And
the second part was at San Diego Base, Albuquerque, New Mexico. I was there for approximately 12 weeks.
And what did that include, that school?
My primary training was nuclear weapons warheads, assemblage, test, storage, and preparation for use.
Did you feel that the training you got was good training?
Are you referring to the technical training itself?
Right, right.
Yes. Well, it's hard to say because there's nothing I can apply it to. The only part that I could apply to possibly is learning how to wiring. There's nothing in nuclear weapons that could be applied to civilian use whatsoever.
How about for your military job itself? Was the training good for what you did in the service?
Yeah. The experience in the idea of having responsibility, being at least partially in a leadership capacity, having at times 200 and some men working for me, which has been an invaluable experience, especially looking for a job.
I see. When did you finally get orders to go overseas to Vietnam? How long were you in the service?
In the sense you're referring to, at least in the Navy, we never got those. I was assigned to a ship, so we left when the ship was left. It really never fazed me until we got there, I think. Mostly due to the fact of being on the ship. It's hard to say, but to give a generality, we were about 65 miles from downtown Hanoi. Or to give a better relationship, it would be like sitting in the middle of Lake Erie and bombing Youngstown. So that's about where we were in relationship from the sea to where downtown Hanoi was.
What was the name of the ship you were on?
Bonhomme Richard, CVA 31.
I see. Then how long were you actually in the area?
Well, I can't give you an accurate count. The best way I can do is give you a generalization. We would be on Yankee Station, or in other words, for combat operations, about 40 days. And we'd be off anywhere from three days to maybe up to 12 days. And we do this on a rotation basis. 1967. We were gone for 7 months, 1968, gone for 10 months, and I was gone in 1969 for about 6 or 7 months. The ship was there for about another 4 or 6 weeks. I left and came back to the United States to get separated.
Well, you spend quite a lot of time there. I see.
So yes.
It's not the kind of thing where then you just got orders like in the Army or the Air Force, and you went over and did a 13-month tour and then came back.
No, it was a steady rotation basis with the United States.
I see. How did you feel though when you first got there? I mean, what were your feelings? Was there anything like, here I am, I'm finally at the war, or this sort of feeling at all, or any fear? What kind of went through your head when you?
No, it really wasn't much different than anything previous, because we used to see the coast once in a while, but not that often, and most of ours was at sea. And by that time, it's hard to say, but I'd already seen enough ocean, so you see one, you see them all. It would take us about a month from the time we left San Diego. It would take us about a week to get to Pearl Harbor, and we'd have to be in Pearl Harbor for a week, 10 days. We had what was called operational readiness exercise. They went through a whole series of mock war games, and you were evaluated. That is, the whole ship, the air wing, everybody as a unit was evaluated by Commander-in-Chief Pacific. And we'd leave Hawaii, take us about 8 days to get to Japan. We'd be in Japan for about 5 days. The basic reason for that was that we would, in a sense, be relieving another aircraft carrier for combat duty. So most of the officers, that is the senior officers, captain, the executive officer, the air operations officer, our weapons officer, and a few of the other senior officers would come on our ship and tell us what they had experienced, so the ship knew what more or less to look forward to. Then we'd be there, as I said, for about 5 days. Take us 3.5, 4 days. We'd go down to the Philippines, take on ordnance. And then it was about 18 hours from there out to Yankee Station. And that's basically the way it would run every
that
year.
That was the pattern.
That was the pattern.
I see. This is quite a lot different than from what, you know, talking to men who were on land, mm-hmm. the Army and the Navy, the Army and the Marines, and even some of the Air Force men. Did you feel that while you were on ship then, you were doing what you were trained for in terms of your training?
No. My primary training, along with those others of us in the division, our primary training was nuclear weapons warheads. Since you're going on through experience, the first year we did nothing but assemble fuses for conventional ordnance. The second year and the third year, they put us working on a conventional bomb. It was called a DST, like a specific type of conventional explosive, and I would say it was no more than maybe 300 men who ever worked on them.
Mm-hmm.
Not to be egotistical or anything, but they basically wanted us to put this special type of explosive together due to the fact of our training, mostly in nuclear weapons. You follow a specific manual and do it step by step by step, et cetera. And this is the reason they wanted us to put them together, because they knew if we put them together through our training, it would more than likely work. Most of our division, men who were my age, had anywhere from 1 to 3 years college. So it was much easier to work with something like that, as opposed to the other ordnance division. Most of them usually were animals, high school dropouts and the rest of them, and trying to get them to do something. As to work on a specific type of ordnance or even a special type of electronics equipment, you couldn't get them to do anything. So.
I see. Yeah. Now, when you went into the service, were you already graduated from college?
No, I had about a year and a half at Kent State.
And were you married at the time?
No.
I see.
I didn't meet my wife till after I knew.
Okay, I see. Now, what was your living conditions like on ship?
Well, let me try and picture. I would say your living room and the kitchen is probably about 35 feet long and probably about 20 feet wide. We had a compartment, and we had 27 racks in there, and that's where we slept. We were fourth deck down, the first compartment in the Bravo section of the ship. Over top of us, we had another berthing compartment. Over that, we had a machinery elevator room for one of the aircraft elevators. And underneath us, we had 35,000 gallons of diesel oil that we had under there. We had three racks high. It was supposed to be air conditioned, but it was about 75 degrees. Most of the temperature in the magazines ran 100, near 100 degrees. Our assemblage area ran over 100 and some. In that sense, yeah, we had it a lot better off than ground pounders did, due to the fact that we used to sleep in a bed. It's better than sleeping standing up. In that condition, food wise, it would vary. Sometimes it was very excellent, and sometimes I wouldn't even feed it to the fish, afraid they would probably kill them. I've gotten food poisoning once or twice off of the food we had. Mostly due to the fact that we carried, fully loaded with an air wing, about 3,000 men. And sometimes the food was good and sometimes it was bad when they prepared in mass numbers, and we fed, I would say, about 21 hours a day. I think breakfast was from 5:30 in the morning, I think, till 8, and then lunch ran from 10 to 1:30, and then I think supper ran from 4 to 8:30, and then we had minrets from about 11 to 1:30 in the morning. So it would be, I think, about 21 hours. I don't know, it's been years. So.
How did your job hour, your duty hours run?
When we were in combat operations, the second and third year, it was 12 hours on, 12 hours off. So I worked a night crew, and we worked 6 at night to 6 in the morning, 7 days a week.
How did you feel about your job itself?
The first year I couldn't stand it because, as I said, due to my training, we were behind locked doors with our guards. We had to wear a badge around our neck. Chicken shit's a hard word to use. It got very bad after a while. I was starting to climb the walls, in effect, because if they didn't have anything to do for us, they'd give us buckets of water and scouring powder and sponges and want us to clean the walls down. And when we got finished with that, we'd sweep the floor out of the magazine, and when we got done with that, we'd swab the deck, and when we got finished with that, we'd go back and clean the walls. Then when it really got bad, they'd find something else for us to do. It was referred to as non-productive busy work.
And how about the second and third years, or the final years?
It was 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I enjoyed it in the sense that at least we did something. We were busy, not from the standpoint of non-productive work, but from the standpoint of actually doing something. One time, a friend of mine, when we were back in the United States, wanted to get off the ship and get transferred back closer to home. He'd been in about 8 or 9 years, and he knew how to go about it. So I went with him over to what was called EPTOPAC, which was Enlisted Personnel Distribution Pacific. They cut most all the orders for people from the Pacific area. In other words, a ship or a unit would send in and say, they would have a report. I don't remember when it was called or how often it had to be sent in. Various rates, I think every 6 months or maybe every quarter, they would say, all right, these are the number of people we are allotted. These are the number of people we have. We're going to be minus so many people by this specific date. We need these many in E1 through E3, E4, E5, 6, et cetera. So he went over there to see if he could get transferred, and he couldn't. And there was an E7 over there working, and he told me they had openings for 6 staff jobs in Saigon, and I signed for that. Unfortunately, I never got it because they canceled the orders. I wanted to get off of there. I wanted to get off and get attached to swift boats or get transferred to frontline combat duty, mostly from the fact of being bored to death.
I see. Well, if I know being in the service and talking to a lot of fellow servicemen, boredom is a major factor in service life at times. What did you do with your leisure time on ship? What did you do to kind of, let's say, forget about boredom? Anything during your 12 hours off?
Mostly we got off work at 6 o'clock in the morning and usually went to sleep by about 7 in the morning and slept till about 4:30 in the afternoon. When we were on 12-hour shifts, it was much easier to just sleep.
What can you do on ship for leisure?
Well, we had a closed-circuit television. We had two networks. One was what was called PLAT, which is plane launch and aircraft takeoff. In other words, they had a closed-circuit television that monitored the flight deck for incoming and incoming aircraft and for launches. So if something happened, they would have at least have a visual record of it. I stood and watched the foresail when she burned. There was 139 men killed on that. They have the films of it, so that's the basic purpose, is for air safety. They have a wreck they can go through and see it. We had another channel they use for other purposes, mostly for recreation for the ship. We would get tapes from stateside. What we get? Something like Ironside is the only thing I can remember, or it's mostly a tape from some of the networks would supply, and they would send them out through the USO or some of the other armed forces recreation branch, and they would play it. It was, well, we had one lifer who was, I think you could refer to as a size 19 neck and a hat size of 0, and a space of about 2 feet in between his ears, which occupied nothing. Unfortunately, there was no moss growing through there. That might have benefited him. They showed all of it at night, which is when we worked. They also turned the fresh water on to take showers after 4 or 5 days, and they did those at night, so we never took a shower. He decided there wasn't any explosives to build, he'd have us do something. He couldn't have us sit by and watch a movie that they would run, or either go take a shower and decide he had to have us do something. So.
When you refer to he, who do you mean?
Oh, he was an E6. His name was Wiesenhahn.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant the same individual with the 0.
But no, that's the same one. Mm-hmm. He was, unfortunately, still alive. I think some of us were. Well, they had him on other ships, and it has been done. They would either put him over the side or, as you know as well as I do from being Southeast Asia, you could usually have somebody done away with for about $5. That's how bad it was in that respect.
I'm really curious in this area about ship life, first of all, because I, you know, have very little knowledge of it. And secondly, I think it's been somewhat romanticized by Hogan's Heroes and just other things that make you think that sailors on ship often have such a good time. If anything, from that those 3 or 4 years you spent on ship, did you make any friends? Did you make any friendships there that you've kept?
Yeah.
That, you know, how friendships and humor keep you going?
Yeah. In fact, this one guy, that's how I met my wife. He and I were on the same ship together for 37 months. And his wife worked with mine, and that's how I met my wife. We still write and still see each other. I have a friend of mine that, well, right now he's the deputy sheriff for one of the southern counties in Oregon. And my wife and I would like to move out to the Northwest, so we'll probably see him, and we still keep in contact with him. So.
That's all right. That's where we're going to.
Yeah,
that's God's country.
The economy doesn't open up, I'm going back to farming.
So we've kind of looked a little bit at the beginning of your experiences here, and talked a little bit about living conditions and food. Something that oftentimes I think comes up is how's the troop morale on board? Now, we've discussed your own.
It all depended upon who was the commanding officer of the ship. Your division officer, and also senior enlisted, either E6 or E7s. I think the morale was highest in the ship when we had one commanding officer whose theory was when we went in for combat operations, you worked 12 to 18 hours a day. When we pulled into port, he expected you to be off the ship at 9 o'clock in the morning. The only ones who were supposed to be left on the ship when that was a duty section, and he expected no work done unless there was an emergency, which was very nice, mostly due to the fact that I was fortunate from being on there of being able to see half the world. Could have been to Hawaii 3 times, been to Japan 9 times, been to the Philippines 20-some. Been there with Hong Kong once, and to Singapore and Malaya, and then across the equator. In the respect, or not respect, but in the idea or frame of reference of being able to go someplace, being able to see something, he was completely the opposite, like day and night, to use that analogy. From the commanding officer previous to him, his idea was he wanted you to work combat operations 12 to 18 hours a day, and then when you pulled into port, he expected you to work from 8 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon, and then get off and hit the beach at about 4:30 or 5 o'clock and be back by midnight. And then with the one we had before that was an alcoholic. In fact, one time we were out off San Diego for underway operations or shakedown, something like this. We came back through the channel, which was maybe 5-8 miles long. And the fog was so thick you couldn't see the nose in front of your face. They wanted him to slow down, and he still did about 20-some knots going through the channel, right over a few buoys and telephone cables. And he really didn't care. Nothing bothered him. So when we were empty, we weighed about 34, maybe 38,000 tons, and he didn't want to slow down, and the ship has no brakes. And one other time we were going out for Dependence Day cruises. Those basically were, they would schedule once a year when we were in the States. You could have your family come on, and they'd bring their wives and kids and everybody out, and they'd go out for an afternoon on San Diego for maybe 5 or 10 miles out. And they'd have a few launchings and landings, and you could go all over the ship, which was enjoyable for a lot of the family to actually see what was going on. Well, on a ship that size, you carried about 8 or 9 lines to untie. And those were hawsers, and a hawser is anything 5 inches or larger in diameter of a rope. So you've got an idea there.
Oh, yeah, right.
So we had about 8 or 9 lines, I think, that would tie the ship up. Well, they didn't get everybody there to untie them, so he said to hell with it and just pulled out, took a few stanchions off the pier with him. So.
Oh, man.
He used to also go out and get drunk and leave his car and then send out half the Marine detachment in San Diego or Honolulu to go find him.
How, for example, when you come into port, and I'm asking this with a complete naivete about how this works, but when you'd go into port, for example, say you finish an operation, how long would you stay in port? What exactly took place? Or can you give me a little background on that? Share some sailor stories or whatever.
You have certain operations have to be done mostly engineering-wise. That is, in the down in the hull, what's referred to, where the turbines, the boilers, and the shafts were. In other words, to slow the speed down on the ship. Okay, then you would have a pilot that would come on board prior to entrance to the channel, because he knew the channel, he knew the currents, the tides, the eddies, he knew the whole channel like the back of his hand. So he would be on the bridge, he would guide the ship in, the helmsman would steer and he would tell him where to go. Depending upon the harbor, whether you were going to anchor out or whether you were going to tie up at the side, they would have tugs would come out and guide you into the pier. Because there's no way you're going to get 45,000 tons of ship to slow down and ease up against a pier. That thing sort of bangs up. The tugs would more or less ease them in. They would normally throw the bow lines over and then would tie them up this way, and then they'd bring the stern in this way. And then they put all the rest of the lines on after that. You usually had 10 or 15 men on the pier, and then you would have, well, we had deck divisions, which were bosun's mates, which did nothing but handle lines and did the painting throughout the majority of the ship, the external part. So they would help tie the ship up. Then they would put the gangway down. Our ship, well, the Navy at that time, outside the United States, was divided into 3 sections. You would have the entire ship would be divided into sections by each specific division. To give you an estimation, our division was 25 men. A deck division would have like 60 men in it. An engineering division would have 60 men. So each division was divided up into 3 sections. At all times, you had to maintain one section on board that ship at all times. So you, in other words, you had 33 1/3% of the crew on board at all times.
Oh, I see.
One time, let's see, what was it, 1969, we just pulled into the Philippines. Most of the ship had taken off and gone, hit the beach. And they came across with emergency flash precedence message. They shot an EC-121 down in North Korea. I'm not sure if you remember that. It was one of those recon planes.
No, I don't recall.
Well, anyways, somebody got scared in the Pentagon, and they sent half the 7th Fleet up to North Korean waters. And they told us we had to go right into combat operations. So we roughly left about 1/3 of the ship on the beach, and they just took off and left. So what they usually do is get a few aircraft together that will carry men and send them back out.
I see.
Or put them on ships and catch them. We had our chief was literally hanging on one of the lines when the ship was pulling away from the pier on the line, crawling up the side. That is nothing unusual.
How long would you be in port?
It would
vary?
Yeah. 1967, we would be in port 3 or 4 days, then go out for 40 some days.
Mm-hmm.
it slacked off in 68, and we'd be in port for, let's see, what was it? Oh, 4 to 8 days. And then, like, 1969, it was really lax. We went up to Japan for, we were in port for 10 days, and we went up into North Korean waters, the Sea of Japan, for 7 days, came back in for another 10 or 12 days, and then turned around and left Sasebo, Japan, and went down as fast as possible. But we hadn't been in any combat operations, and I think we made it to, with about a half hour to go at the end of the month, so we sent one plane into North Vietnam just to hit the territorial combat zone and come back. So the entire 3,000 men collected combat pay and non-taxable for the entire month. So,
good for you. I wondered, now going back to when you're in port, two questions come up. First is, what basically could you do, what did you do when you were in port?
Well, it all depended on where you were. The Philippines, most of us would either go out to Grande Island. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Harbury, but it was a huge one. It was about 10 or 15 miles across.
Mm-hmm.
That's an overestimation. It was a very large harbor. There was an island out in the middle. Maybe it was the size of Wick Park. That would give you an idea. Mm-hmm. It's been over 5 years. Then there was another island. There was one small bar out there near the hotel. And then there was another large bar that was mostly just, it was covered.
Mm-hmm.
They had large screens on it. So, I got a lot of diving time in. The water was about 60 feet deep. You could see the bottom. We were doing a lot of diving out there, and then we'd quit about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon and spend the rest of the time doing nothing but drinking beer. And the rest of the time, if you didn't have anything else to do, you could go in town. The town's population would fluctuate anywhere from, at least they told us, about 75,000 to 150,000, depending upon the ships we're in. Subic Bay, which was a naval station, was the furthest point the United States had bases outside of Vietnam. The downtown stretch had, I think I'm off my estimation, but I've stood shore patrol in that entire section at one time or another. It was about 5 to 7 mile stretch of dirt road. It was about 15 hotels, about 12 restaurants, and about 400 bars, and about 4,000 prostitutes. And I've come to find out from doing some more readings that there was roughly $250,000 a month that went outside that gate that supported that town. Most of the money usually went for to the whorehouses or to alcohol. There was very, very little dope that went through that place. I don't. When I left there in '69. I don't think there was any grass that went through there. There were counterfeit money. There was counterfeit money that was printed and circulated. There might have been any type of dope that was run through there. That I really couldn't tell you after I left.
How were you received, as sailors received?
It all depended upon where you were. I really didn't like the Philippines too much,
mm-hmm.
mostly due to the fact that I stood shore patrol in that place enough times. It's an extremely violent society, and I still keep up with it, which was part of the basis, you probably might have some more questions on, but it was part of the basis for my studies in the university, because I have a minor in East Asian history, or Asian history. So I saw some of it firsthand. I still keep up on it.
Mm-hmm.
Philippines is a very tight society in the fact that it is a military dictatorship run by Marcos. He has a national police force called a constabulary. They would shoot first and ask questions later, because I've seen them do it. The mayor who ran the city, she took over from her husband after somebody got him with six hand grenades one time. She carried her own private army of 150 stormtroopers, if you want to use that term. They were all short little Filipinos at about my size, which made them about 5'6", and I weighed 125 pounds then. That's about what they weighed. They all wore very stiff starch khakis. They used to wear a 45 strapped around their waist. One shoulder they carried a Thompson submachine gun, and the other one they carried a sawed-off riot gun. I remember one night I came out of a bar, I was so drunk, I was seeing double. I sobered up in about 10 minutes, because two of them were coming down the street, and one had a pump shotgun with a clip on it, and he had the handle, the stock taken off and had a pistol grip on it. And the other one had a Thompson submachine gun and a few other clips strung around his shoulders. They used to have a lot of petty thievery, and I've literally seen them kill them, a half a dozen of them for it. They used to wear watches, and they would wear the real thin bands, and they would come up on your arm and grab the back of it and just yank it, so the watch would come off intact, so the band would drop off. You can always replace the band when they wanted to sell it. And they would take them over and give them to somebody else and trade them off. And this one night, I know because I was standing short patrol, and this one guy had his watch stolen. This one Filipino was running down toward this one bridge and jumped off the bridge into the water, is waiting for some guy to pick him up, and one of them leaned over with a 12-gauge shotgun and blew him apart in midair. He hit the water in about a dozen pieces. That was normality for that place. Robbery and murder was nothing unusual. That was normal day activities. If you got outside of the city, it wasn't bad. I'm using the term peasant in connection with a background in anthropology, and the fact that it was not primitive, nor was it industrial or technological society. They were peasants. They were farmers, rice farmers. They had water buffalo, if they were lucky. We were about 90 miles west of Manila. I was down in Manila once. There's nothing more than another major, large metropolitan city like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Mexico City, Rome, Paris, Tokyo, etc. The greater majority of the Philippines was a peasant society, as I mentioned. A lot of it very backwards, very little education. You probably saw that with the greater majority of the people that lived outside the cities. It was a peasant society. In other words, they were farmers. Most of them very poor. Singapore I enjoyed very much. In fact, my wife and I still write to a girl that I met in Singapore. She and her family run a furniture store. They actually make furniture there. We still correspond with them. I enjoyed Singapore very much. It is a free port, in other words, non-taxable for anything, which again is helped me in university studies in anthropology. They survive, that is, their economy survives due to trade. Singapore has a gold dollar exchange, like there's a European, the Euro dollar. Well, they have one for the Asian dollar. They run it out of Singapore. A lot of American industries have invested in Singapore in electronics manufacturing there. I enjoyed it. It was an extremely unusual place due to the fact that it's 100 and some square miles and about 2.25 million people. A lot of people from Malaya. The Chinese make up the greater percentage of the population. You had the Indians were there. Most of them served as guards. Let's see what else. It was very unusual in the fact that you would have like a slum and like two streets down from that in parallel would be the embassies. And like I remember we had the Thailand embassy was right down from a bar that we used to go to, and across from that was a Mercedes-Benz dealer.
Contrast.
Extremely. More so, yeah, it was more of a contrast than Hong Kong was.
Did, when you got back on ship and so forth after possibly being in port, whether it was a place you liked or not, got all the men back together on ship, did you have any problems then stemming from any racial incidents?
No, we had no racial incidents whatsoever.
Because
that is in the time frame that I was on the ship from August of 66 till September 69, we had none.
And you didn't have any drug problems?
Drug problems, the only that we had were from marijuana. I think there might have been one or two acid freaks, if you want to use that term, not derogatory, but it's a classification term. Nobody on hardcore dope.
Wasn't widespread then, was it?
No, the only thing they did, I think, was like 1968, they busted 200 and some guys. Article 15, the Navy calls it captain's mess for dope, for marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
That was automatic. If you were E4, they reduced you. Okay, if you were E4 or up NCO grade, they reduced you one step. If you were E3 and below, they put them in the brig for 30 days. And if you held a security clearance, it was worse. They yanked it.
Yeah.
So that's why none of us bothered with it.
Yes, I know. They use that technique in the Army, too.
So the outlet, I'm trying to get away from structured terms in anthropology or sociology or the rest of the ologies, but more or less the accepted outlet was alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you were drunk, they wouldn't bother with you. But if you started to touch grass, that's another world unto its own.
Now, as far as the ship itself, aside from the off-duty hours, when you did go into combat operations, how did it work? Talk a little bit about combat operations.
Basically, to go from year to year is the easiest way to use it.
Okay, fine.
We got into combat in 1967 around the end of February. 1967. We did a few combat operations for a while. I think it was the 17th or 18th of May. I can't remember exactly. It was about 4 or 5 days after Mother's Day. There was ours and three other aircraft carriers, and they lined them all up at the same time out there and sent 400 aircraft into downtown Hanoi in flights, one right after another. Managed to level 55% of the thermal power producing, that is the coal electrical generating plants, the rail yards, we were awarded the Navy unit citation for that one. Then the rest of that time we were confined to the areas of downtown Hanoi in the industrial sections of downtown Hanoi, and the thermal power producing plants or generators plants. I know you're going to ask this question. In the 3 years that I was there, and I have slides of them at home, none of the pilots ever intentionally went into any of the villages. If they ever bombed a village, it was by accident. I know I've seen the combat photos. The only other, let's see what else. We went into an airfield called Kep, which is about 37 miles south of the Chinese border. And they've got 5 MiGs on the ground there. There was air-to-air combat off and on for the 3 years. Our ship managed, well, the pilots did, 19 MiGs in 3 years, shot down. In 1967, we lost, which were the heaviest losses. We lost 25 aircraft and 20 pilots. And some of the POWs that came back, 73. I'm sorry, sometimes it skips me. I remember watching some of the pilots come back, and I had known 2 or 3 of them myself. And they were lost in 1967. And they've been prisoners of POW since 1967. The rest of our combat operations in 1967 were confined to major industrial and government logistics supply lines. 1968, we were gone for about 10 months. Went into port facilities in Hongye, which were north-northeast of Haiphong Harbor, and then very large in Pian, port facilities in Vinsan. We also flew for about 40 days out of 77 days, flew cover support for the Tet Offensive for the Marines who were pinned down in Kaesong. That was very heavy bombing. That was some of the heaviest I've ever seen. There was continual operations. All that I know about that was what I read in Stars and Stripes, and they were publishing the death list then until they stomped it. And it must, horde is a bad word to use. It must have been slaughter on both sides, tremendous, because just from the amount of ordnance that we put out in that time, find cover support for the Marines.
Could we just for a moment stop on Tet, just look at it just a little closer. Again, I think the questions here are of a more ad-lib nature on my part because, again, I have a certain naivete about your operations. Mm-hmm. But you said you put out a lot of ordnance. Now, what did you have flying off your ship? What type of aircraft?
A-4, which were a daylight attack aircraft. F-8s, which were an older aircraft. We also flew 2 or 3 F-8s as fighter photo, which, by the way, the photographic equipment weighed more than machine guns, so the only armament the pilots had was the 38 they carried under their shoulders. You know, I wouldn't fly one of those things for anything. We carried 2 whales, which was a nickname there. The Navy lists them as an A-3. The Air Force lists them as a B-66. 1967, we carried the last squadron of SPADs, which were the propeller-driven A-1 Sky Raiders finished from Korean War. We sold those. The Air Force took them from us, and the United States government in turn sold them to Cambodians, and I watched them on NBC News getting blown up in Phnom Penh. It was the same aircraft we carried, which
actually. They were very good, if you know, for combat aircraft in that area. Single propeller, reciprocating engine. Could fly very low and very slow. It was almost impossible to shoot one of those things down. I've seen them come back in bullet holes all through those things and still fly. And I've seen some of the jets. You put bullet holes through the side of them and a jet flies like a lead balloon and they're hit. They just made it and drop. I've seen some of them come back. If they hit them in the wing, they weren't too bad. I saw one or two of them come back with holes big enough you could walk through them. A lot of others were shot up, either pilots shot up or hydraulic equipment all banged up.
Now, when, let's see if I can trace this a little clearer in my own mind, too.
Okay.
Say you were going into an operation, you were going to send ships, planes out for a certain
okay, volume. How did it work?
Yeah, for example, did you get closer to shore? How did this situation work?
I was fortunate also. I used to read the orders. Preliminary orders, I think for a periodic, like a month or 6 weeks, combat operations would come out of staff Saigon. Overall plans would come out of Honolulu, Commander-in-Chief Pacific. They would formulate the plans, then they in turn would also have a daily bombing schedule for 24 hours. They would send the messages out because I used to pick the messages up. They would say, all right, these are the targets that you will be assigned, these specific dates, and they used to give us like a six-week advance notice, okay. They in turn would, that is the ship, would publish two lists. One was a combat ordnance sheet, and the other one was an aircraft sheet. The aircraft sheet used to list the aircraft by its number, by its squadron, which was going in which flight, and they would send approximately 25 aircraft out on a launch. They would give them on that sheet the fuel that they would, in 1,000 pounds that they would carry. The ordnance sheet would tell you what type of bomb you had, what type of fin configuration you had. Did you have a tail fuse? Did you have a nose fuse? Did you have electromechanical fuse? Did you have a time delay? Did you have a cookie cutter on them? Let's see what else. Did you use DSTs? Did we use, I was one of those other ones and I can't remember. Smart bombs. We never used napalm. It was too dangerous. Because part of our flight deck was wood. It was bad enough. We carried napalm tanks, but they never let us use it. It was too dangerous. They didn't want anything happening. The one thing about the Navy that makes a difference from the rest of the services, in the other services, if a plane crashes, or you have a tremendous explosion or accident, everybody gets in a bunch of vehicles and goes like a bat out of hell someplace. You're in the middle of the ocean, there's no place to go except swim. And we used to have sea snakes up there. So basically, flight operations, to get back to this, flight operations would be on a 12-hour basis from whenever they would start and they would end 12 hours later. We would get the ordnance sheet from Ordnance Control. They would publish it. They used to go up to the weapons office and pick it up because I used to run the night turn. I had another E6, the idiot that was in charge of the whole thing, but he usually sat upstairs and didn't do anything except create messes for us. We didn't have anything else to do. So we'd bring it back down, figure out how many DSTs we had to put together, or other type of explosives, how many fuses we had to put together. Then we'd spend the rest of the night doing nothing but assembling the ordnance.
Did the ship itself then move in
no.
at all?
No, they would move in some. Basically what it was They called it Yankee Station because it was shaped like a Y.
Mm-hmm.
At all times, you would carry three aircraft carriers, one at each end or terminus of the Y.
Yeah.
You would go in a big oval shape, and it would be about a 300-mile in 24 hours. I don't know how long the oval was. I would probably say 50 miles from one end of the oval to the other. All we would do for launching of aircraft would be to turn into the wind. It would launch approximately 25 aircraft at a time. So what they would do is flight quarters would go about an hour and a half before launch. So at that time, they would have all the aircraft prepped and ready to go. They'd run all the ordnance to the flight deck, which was called the roof, load them, fuel them, make the last-minute mechanical checks that you had on a checklist if you were familiar with aircraft or any other of these type of equipment. Line them up on the flight deck the way they were supposed to go in order or precedence of launch. Launch would come up, and they would send them out. All right, as soon as the last aircraft was off the deck, they would turn out of the wind and go back onto their other path or circle. That would give you an hour and a half between the next launch, rather than the next recovery, because you recovered them, then they launched them. I can't remember. I'm trying to think. No, they would launch them, and then they would recover the previous flight, you know. So what they would do in between that hour and a half from the first launch, they'd bring up 25 more aircraft. They would fuel them, load them with the ordnance, make the last mechanical checks, align them up the way they were supposed to by preference of launch, launch the aircraft while they were still in the wind. Then they would recover the other 25 aircraft from the first launch, and then you just keep going in a circle like that for 12 hours.
Well, John, when you were on ship, on duty and so forth, or even off duty, it doesn't matter, and all the time you were there, did your ship itself ever come under any attack by the enemy? Were you ever in any situation where you were?
We had two or three, I think. We had PT boats in 1967 that were coming out. We were fortunate. That's why we carried the propeller-driven aircraft, the A1s, the SPADs. They were slow enough and could fly low enough to usually get rid of the, that is, destroyed PT boats that came out. After that, the majority of ours was due to some foul-up someplace. We had one time. It scared the hell out of almost everybody. We took on fuel every other day, and then the other days we took on 160 tons of explosives. I used to be in the hangar deck, and I used to have all the ordnance come on board, and then I was responsible for the unpackaging and the transfer to all the magazines of those 160 tons, and I used to have 200 men working for me. We had all 160 tons, or the greater majority of it, on board. The rest of it was on the ammunition ship that was alongside of us, which is called UNREP, which is short for Underway Replenishment, where both ships slow down to 8 knots and steer on one continuous course, and they transfer on a high line and across at sea. At that time, we had most of the ordnance was transferred on board our ship. On the ammunition ship, they had the remainder all out on deck. There was an unidentified aircraft that was picked up on the radar scope, and they could get no radio communications with them.
Mm-hmm.
It was too far out for visual communication, so they called what is referred to as air quarters. So everybody who was who had stations for aircraft went up. They launched one aircraft, and before they could get up there, they called general quarters, which is more or less all hands man your battle station. and that probably scared everybody to death, mostly because of the fact they didn't know what it was, and we had heard rumors due to the fact of where most of us worked that somebody in intelligence had gotten word someplace that some of the North Vietnamese wanted to try a suicide mission. With a few MiG aircraft loaded with as many explosives as they could get on there and try and fly it in the middle of one of the aircraft carriers. So we all slightly nervously, I would say as an understatement, went down to our battle stations, and I was fortunate. Mine was 10 feet below the water line and sat on top of 2,000-pound bombs with 96,000 gallons of aviation gasoline. So if anything happened, you didn't know it.
What happened to the, was it a...
It ended up to be one of ours whose radio was broken up and couldn't...
I see.
The rest of ours, problems at least, it wasn't too much of a combat activity, were accidents. There were about 20-some men that were killed on the Oriskany. There were another 20 or 30 that were killed on the Kitty Hawk. I watched a forest all burn. There were 134 men killed on that. Most of them, most of ours were accidents. We had not too much in the way of combat activities. That is danger from being killed from the North Vietnamese or the Chinese or et cetera. Most of ours was due to accident. I've come across that several times. We had two or three times somebody would send back down a load of 500-pound bombs on a truck where they would have two bombs on top and one on the bottom and a triangle only reversed. They sent them back down and they didn't strap them down and they would fall off and roll across the bomb assembly area. And usually one or two of us would stay there because we figured it went up, it wouldn't make any difference. And I've never seen people run so fast in my entire life. And so we usually would put the pin back into it so it wouldn't go off, or either to stop the timer, and then they would call EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal, and come down and get rid of the thing. So just figure it was much easier just taking care of it there. You can't run very far. Or as they used to say, you stand on the bow of the Enterprise, you're 1,500 feet from ground zero, so it doesn't make any difference.
Did you, during any period of time, although I think I already know the answer to this, but I'd like to ascertain this, did you have any chance to go into Vietnam at all in your service?
Myself? No.
Yeah.
We would be the last ones that would ever go in. There was no reason for us to go in.
So in other words, you never went on land, met the people of Vietnam or the people who...
No, I was never inshore. The closest I ever got was seeing the shoreline. If we would get that close, and then we used to see I never saw them, but we used to see the flashes at night from the 155s up in the DMZ. Get down there.
Did your ship have guns on board that did shell?
No.
No.
We carried 4 5-inch 38 calibers, but those were only as a defense.
Defensive.
We never shelled. Those would be tin cans. And if you want somebody else to talk to, I can get hold of him, who was a mound captain on the can.
Sure. We'll talk when we finish up. Possibly we could get his address. I'd be interested. But getting back then specifically to your situation, since you didn't get into Vietnam, I would think then that your conception of the enemy was an impersonal one.
Yeah. We picked up, I think, 6 or 7 Vietnamese one time in a sampan. We never knew what they were, whether they were South Vietnamese or whether they were North Vietnamese regulars or Viet Cong or what. The only other contact we came into was bit the Chinese and the Russians. If we would lose something, we would have it. There would usually be a trawler up there. And we had a standing joke, if we couldn't find four or five bombs, we'd call them up and ask them, because they could tell us where they were.
They were active?
Yes. We used to have flyovers by the Soviet Air Force in the middle of the Pacific. The rest of the time that we were up in the territorial contingent waters of North Vietnam, we had a Chinese trawler with us all the time. Not with us, but within that area, at least one. And as I said, it was a standing joke. If we couldn't find any bombs and we couldn't account for them, we'd call them up and ask them.
Were there ever any clashes with them?
No. We never had any. They still have some in the Mediterranean. They would stay far enough away from us. There have been enough incidents, and I know enough from other people who have been on other ships who had incidents with the Russians that sometimes the American ships wouldn't stop if they would come in their path. They'd just keep going and the Russians would move, usually at the last minute.
Was speculation that these ships were there basically for reconnaissance or intelligence purpose?
Oh, most of us knew what they were there for, at least. I had one friend that used to work in their intelligence, so I used to talk to him a lot. Their primary purpose was there to monitor all our radio traffic and as a photographic and observation.
Mm-hmm.
So they was, you know, we understood what they were there for, and we knew what we were.
John, I'd like to move now from the war itself into another area, and that's reflections on the war. We've discussed how long you were there and some of the things you did. How did you feel about the war itself and what you were doing?
I would have to say, with all honesty and sincerity, that I really had no opinion before I went in. I would assume I was probably along with the other 98% of them. Who was for it? Why? I don't know. It was just the American stigma, I guess. In fact, I still remember when I was at Kent State, before I left school up there, there was a demonstration. Can we talk about it? Okay. There was a demonstration up there because the United States was bombing, that is, retaliatorial bombing, a few of the North Vietnamese ports. And there was like maybe a half a dozen people that were demonstrating against it. This was at Kent State, and it's something to see the contrast between. This was like in the spring of '65, just before I left, and to see what happened 5 years later, the complete opposite. When I was over there, I had no opinion. I think maybe it was no opinion for the war, no opinion against of it. I would assume it was. I was probably more for it than anything else. I would probably say mostly because of the fact of being actually removed from it. When I got out, it was completely the opposite because of the fact of going back to school and doing nothing but sitting and talking to a lot of other ones who had been over there. And to see what had gone on, and after a while it started to bother me. In fact, it took me about a year to readjust from some of that. Because, well, it's changed me considerably. Going from one end, going on from the American idea almost to the other end, to categorize myself, I think, maybe as much as possible, is to be a pacifist, if you can use it. To be a true pacifist is very difficult, but I've learned now from actually being through one. Actually, what war is and what it does. And I've been fortunate enough to be in the university now and to be able to read a great deal. And coming to one conclusion that
after 5,000 years of recorded history, warfare hasn't done any good except to kill a lot of people.
You think then the war was a waste? It was worthwhile?
It was extremely beneficial to me, in the fact of seeing something from the standpoint of warfare and what a society can actually do and the technology that man can amass to kill somebody else. It was bad from the standpoint of from the 50,000 that we lost, at least in combat. And the only thing that really ever bothers me is I've seen some of the TV shows and see some of the ones that are paraplegic or quadriplegic that no longer in one hole from due to that war, due to some accident from it. In reflection and retrospect, yes, it's been an extreme benefit to find out that warfare doesn't solve anything. It's completely changed.
Do you think that My Lai has taught the American people anything?
No, I don't think so. From all that I have read from that, I really don't know, and I don't think anybody will ever know whether that was deliberate. I think I was fortunate enough from being in school at that time with enough veterans that things like that do happen. If it was actually premeditated, that's one story. If it was an accident, that's something else. It could be one or two ways. I don't know. Has it taught anybody a lesson? No, I don't think so, because I know when I worked in the mills while I was going to school when I got out of the service that I have learned from a lot of ones who were in World War II that the same thing happened. It was never publicized. The only ones that knew about it were those people that were involved with it or who heard about it directly.
You think that Cali was a scapegoat?
It's hard to say. Knowing the service as I do now, I would probably say Cali was scapegoat, yes. And I think some of the senior officers got off of it, or got out of it without getting hurt. Some of them had to resign, which was punishment for them. But mm-hmm. The armed services, I found out, is like a lot of other corporations or institutions. They will do everything to protect the institution itself, and they will protect the ring clankers. And he was not a commissioned officer from West Point, so therefore he was only separate. But Dina, I think, was a 20 or 30 year man who was a Mustanger. So they didn't seem to bother him. The rest of them were all ring clankers from West Point, and they weren't going to bother them. A cover-up is one thing, but if he was actually guilty, of mass murder, that's something else. If it was deliberate, that's one story, but, if it was by an accident from reading and talking to other ones who were actually ground pounders who were involved in situations like that, it could have been for self-defense. I don't know. Nobody will ever know except for him and those ones that survived it.
Well, I have two final questions, John. One, again, is a little of the more controversial nature, and then I have a final question. First, amnesty. What's your feeling on amnesty now, having looked back at the war, having gone through it yourself, having seen what it does to people, and what it's still doing to some people?
Well, to make a final and absolute decision, I would have to go back through and read the history books. If amnesty has been granted, to personnel in other wars, in other words, from World War II, from the First World War, et cetera, back. There's no reason not to allow amnesty for this war. They've given, well, partial amnesty, if you want to call it that. Amnesty, you know, it all depends. There's a certain legal requirement, and there's a philosophical background, and I'm looking at more from a philosophical
right.
background.
Right, okay.
I really don't know. I see no reason why those guys shouldn't come back. I, in all honesty, I have a great deal of respect for them. It took an awful lot of courage, an awful lot of guts to take off in this country and to go either to Canada or go to Sweden or go someplace else and not go to the war. That is, provided they did it on a moral, conscientious, objectionable grounds and not as some of them who I've heard from who have... they just didn't want to go because they didn't want to face up to the military service. There was nothing. They just didn't want any part of it, not due to the fact that it was a war. It's just the fact that they didn't get drafted. But to repeat again, I do have a great deal of respect for a lot of those ones that did go to Canada because they were conscientious objectors. They did not want to go to war, and they didn't want to kill anybody, or did not want to have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to judge somebody by that. In other words, you can say, you know, we are going to give amnesty to those people, you know. But how many of them took off and left because they didn't, you know, they didn't want to run. They just didn't want anything to do with it.
It's a difficult question. I know. Argued and talked to people before. And
I would have to read the history books first to see what they say.
Well, as a sort of a final question, although there's never really any final question or anything like this, reflecting upon your own experience now, just your own experience, what's your overall feeling about it? In other words, would you do it again? What's your overall impression? What do you still carry with you from your experience?
If I had to do it over again, I don't know. Hindsight is always better than foresight, so it's very difficult to say. I really don't know. When I went, that is when I was conducted into the service, that is enlisted to keep them getting drafted. There were very few resistors. There were very few people who refused to serve on conscientious grounds. I don't know. Again, to go back to saying it, I was very fortunate in what I did. Mostly because of the fact I came back in one piece. It's taught me a lot. What warfare is and what it can be. It's unfortunately a waste, but nobody seemed to learn that in 5,000 years of history. So we continue to repeat their mistakes again. It taught me a lot in the fact of how far I can actually push myself, and in other words, how little sleep can I go on, how much work I can do, and how little food I can go on to, and how far I can push myself in those terms. It was a benefit in the fact of having responsibilities. And the fact of being in charge of various operations and having people work for me, beginning the, well, leadership experience, if you want to put it that way, has been an immense benefit. I found it's much harder to give orders than it is to follow them. It's much easier to do what somebody tells you than to sit down and figure out what has to be done and how to persuade people to do it. Telling somebody to do something isn't doing any good. All you're going to do is get across to them that you have authority, and authority doesn't accomplish too much. I don't know, there's a lot of other that I've thought about, but I don't know, maybe I haven't thought about too much of it lately. I would sort of think, because there are not that many veterans down at school, we don't hang around together much more, because most of them that I knew have graduated and moved. There's really not that too much of like war stories to go around anymore. I would consider the greater majority of us that are down there now in the great minority. If you mention anything about it to any of the ones that are down in school now, they look at you because they were in high school, or some of them in junior high school, and they have no comprehension or the comprehension period of what it was because they were in high school. I really don't know what else I can add to it.
Thank you, John, for sharing, you know, your experiences with us. And if there's anybody else you might know that has also gone through the war and is at the university, appreciate finding out who it is. Maybe we could talk to him.